Good morning again. Are we online this morning? Is everything good? We had a technology breakdown last week, and so we weren't online. So I want to welcome all of you that were sitting here for an entire week waiting for the service to start. Welcome. We're glad you chose to hang with us. So in 1982, the New England Patriots played the Miami Dolphins in what has become known as Snowplowgate. During the game, the snow was so heavy that the teams agreed to allow a snowplow to come through and clear the yard markers so that they knew where the yard markers on the field were. Near the end of the game, as the New England Patriots had an opportunity to kick a field goal, the snowplow driver was driving and clearing and made a little detour to clear a spot where the New England Patriots kicker would plant his feet to kick the ball for the field goal. The kick was good. The Patriots won, and the Dolphins said the Patriots cheated, though they were given the opportunity to have a place cleared for their kicker at another point in the game. In 1986, the New England Patriots were accused by the NFL of misusing the injured reserve process of the league to their benefit. And again, in 2013, they were accused of doing the same thing. In 2002, the New England Patriots were accused by the St. Louis Rams of something that became known as Spygate, where they were filming the practices of the St. Louis Rams before the Super Bowl and to learn their offensive and defensive plays. In 2007, the New England Patriots were punished by the NFL for Spygate 2, in which they were improperly filming plays and sideline behavior of the New York Jets. From 2007 to 2016, six players from the NFL team, the New England Patriots, were suspended by the NFL for improper use of performance-enhancing drugs. In 2015, there was an NFL scandal that was called Formationgate. And the Baltimore Ravens accused the New England Patriots of using illegal formations during their games. And in 2015, this was a good year, in 2015, the New York Jets leveled allegations of cheating, of tampering with one of their players. Turns out that the Jets were actually the ones who were guilty of tampering in this particular situation. And then in 2015, the Pittsburgh Steelers, it became known as Headset Gate. The Pittsburgh Steelers were playing the New England Patriots in Foxborough, and for the first 14 minutes of the game, the Pittsburgh Steelers coaching staff's headsets were playing the New England Patriots radio broadcast in their headsets. Conveniently, when an NFL official came to shut down the New England Patriots headsets, because they have this equal, if your headsets don't work, you can't use headsets and all that. So they went down to shut down the New England Patriots headsets. And when they went down to shut them off, the Pittsburgh Steelers headsets started working until the NFL official left the area, and then it started broadcasting the Patriots radio network again. And then in 2015, the New England Patriots were accused of deflating footballs in an AFC playoff game against the Indianapolis Colts. And it became this long ordeal as to whether they did or didn't, and who knew and who didn't know, and who got suspended and who didn't get suspended, and the team got fined and all that. It became known as Deflategate. So, in all of these instances, there's a common thread. You tell me, what's the common thread? There you go. The common thread is the New England Patriots apparently are a bunch of cheaters. As a Colts fan, and interestingly enough, when I put the intro to this message together and put this message on this day, I had no idea that it would be the day that the Colts and the Patriots play in Germany. So, So anyway, if we're able, as a Colts fan, the Patriots have been our nemesis, and when they're accused of cheating, we jump on the wagon and say, of course they cheated because they're the Patriots, and the Patriots cheat, and all that. And then when the Patriots actually are found guilty and punished for cheating, we take even more pride in that and cheer even more the fact that not only were they accused of cheating, but they got caught cheating, which we knew they cheated because they cheat, and they're a bunch of cheaters. But if even as a Colts fan, if we can put our objective lenses on for just a minute, it's not just the Patriots who cheat in the NFL. And it's not just the NFL is not the only sport in which people cheat. And it's not just sports in which people cheat. The reality is that cheating is more pervasive than many of us realize or want to accept. And sometimes some of us cheat without even realizing we cheat. So there comes a question about why do people cheat? Well, the short answer is people cheat because winning is a whole lot better than not winning. And we're competitive and we want to win. And the Patriots cheat because they want to win a Super Bowl. People cheat on their taxes because they want to beat the system and have more money at the end and not give the government what they don't think the government should have. And the kid cheats on the test because they want the better grade. People cheat at work because we want to achieve more, accomplish more, and be perceived as a winner, because winning is a whole lot better than not winning. But if we keep our objective lenses on, we have to sometimes wonder, people cheat because people are competitive, and people are competitive because winning is better than not winning. I mean, that's the short answer, right? But then, have you ever noticed that sometimes it's possible to win, but still lose? Do you ever realize that it's possible to get the better grade on the test, but lose because you compromised your integrity in the process? Do you realize that it's possible to cheat on your taxes and have an extra $50 on your tax refund, but the price of your integrity and your honesty and your character just became $50, and all of a sudden you feel like you lost? So the question that comes up in this that we have to ask and answer is, what's the win? If we don't ask and answer this question in our own life, the world around us or the people, somebody's going to answer this question. And we're going to make decisions in life based on how we answer this question. We will never win in our relationships if we don't know what the win is relationally. We will never win at our jobs if we don't know what the win is at our job. We will never win the race if we don't know where the finish line is. When we try to navigate life without answering this question, we will run and run and run to the point of sheer exhaustion and never feel like we win because we don't ever know what the win is. Trying to navigate life without answering this question is like trying to run a race without the course being laid out. It's like trying to run a race without knowing where the finish line is. You actually finished the race 50 yards ago, but kept running because you had no idea that the race was over because you didn't know what the win was. We have to ask and answer the question, what is the win in life? What is it that we are pursuing? What is it that really matters? And then how do we navigate and design and approach life around what the win is? The early church leader, Paul, entered the pages of history as a Jewish Pharisee by the name of Saul. And the win for Saul was to protect and preserve the Jewish religious system and the Jewish way of life. The Jesus movement posed a threat to the Jewish religious movement and the Jewish way of life. And so Paul set out. One of the wins for Paul, who was Saul at the time, was set out, was to eradicate the Jesus movement. He traveled the region, and he had followers of Jesus arrested. He had them persecuted and tortured, and he even had some of them put to death. All the time, he thought that as he accomplished this, he was winning for God. He was accomplishing what needed to be accomplished. The win for him was preserving the Jewish religious way of life. And as he did that, he felt as he was winning for God. Until he had a personal encounter with the resurrected Jesus. And after he had a personal encounter with resurrected Jesus, the win for Paul shifted from trying to put an end to the Jesus movement to inviting people to follow Jesus. And he reordered his entire life around that win. And he wrote a letter to the first century church in Corinth that talks about this idea of steps that he could take to accomplish this win of inviting people to follow Jesus. And he said, "Though I am free and belong to no one," and this is clearly talking about his status as a Jewish individual and as a Greek and Roman, a Greek citizen. And he basically is saying, I don't fall into a camp like you understand them. He said, "Though I am free and belong to no one, I have made myself a slave to everyone." Now, we tend to bristle right away when we hear the word slave. And understandably so, because the word there, the word slave, has connotations that should make us bristle. The Greek word that's used there is a Greek word called doulos. And if you're a note taker and you want to write it down, it's the English transliteration would be D-O-U-L-O-S. Doulos. The word literally means servant. And so Paul says, "I have made myself a servant." In this culture, a slave was considered more of someone who was an indentured servant than a slave as we understand it to be from our national history. And a servant in this day was brought in and really kind of made part of the family. And generally speaking, they were treated fairly well. There were other instances where they weren't. And all that, but generally speaking, they were treated fairly well. And so Paul's saying, I am making myself a servant to win as many as possible. And there's the win for him, to win as many as possible, to convince people that Jesus is the very Son of God, sent to redeem sin and to provide the path to right relationship with God for all who will place their trust in him. My win now is going from persecuting people for believing that to trying to convince people to believe in that. And then he goes on to say, "To the Jews, I became like a Jew." Well, that seems a little odd, because you were a Jew. You are Jewish. That's your background. That's your history. You rose through the ranks of the education system. You rose through the ranks of the religious system. You served on one of the highest councils in the Jewish religious leadership. And so it seems odd that you would say, "To the Jews, I became like a Jew." Well, what he's saying there is that he found common ground with the Jews. Remember, he had just said, "Though I am free and belong to no one." So he no longer has to adhere to the Jewish religious system the way they understood it. He says, to the Jews, I became like a Jew. So he found common ground with them. And when he was with the Jews, he ate what the Jews ate. He drank what the Jews drank. He wore the same types of clothes. He found common ground with them for the win, to win the Jews, to convince them that Jesus was the long-awaited Messiah who would redeem and restore Israel, but not just Israel. And he said, to those under the law. So under the law is the Jewish law as they understood it. He said, I became like one under the law. I accepted those laws. I lived those ways. Though I myself am not under the law. So now here's a Jewish person who became a follower of Jesus who says, I'm no longer under the Jewish law. Because Jesus and relationship with him set him free from the understanding of the Jewish law. So as to win those under the law. Now, Paul makes it clear that his win isn't just exclusively for the Jews. He says, to those not having the law. So these would be non-Jews, non-Greeks. The law, the Jewish people believed that the law was given to them by God through Moses on Mount Sinai, and they lived under the law. They just so you know, there were 613 of the Jewish laws, which they believed to be God's law. So he said, to those not having the law, so people that have no Jewish background, Greeks, Romans, Gentiles, they were known as Gentiles. He said, I became like one of them, not having the law. So in other words, when he was with the Gentiles, who didn't always understand Jewish law, and in some ways were repulsed by Jewish law, he said, I found common ground with them. I tried to approach so that there was no barrier between them and God because of the Jewish law. He said, so when he was with the Gentiles, he would eat the foods they ate, many of which were forbidden by Jewish law to be eaten by a Jew. He would drink what they drank, some of which was forbidden by Jewish law to drink, and he would wear the types of clothes, and he would connect with them through their own ways to win as many as possible. That's his win. So when he's with the Jews, he becomes like a Jew. When he's with them, he becomes like them. He says, though I am not free from God's law, which the Jews would have heard the Jewish law, but he's already said, I'm not under that law. You with me? Okay, hang on. But am under Christ's law. When Jesus was asked a question about what was the greatest commandment out of the Jewish law, Jesus said, I'm going to sum it all up for you. I don't know if he said it that way, but I like to think. I'm going to sum it all up for you. Take all the 613 commands, most of which were added by the Jewish religious leaders to interpret the law the way they wanted. I mean, that was just the deal. I'm going to sum it all up for you. I'm going to give you two things. Love God and love others. And then, as Jesus is preparing to hand off his job of inviting people to follow him before he returns to heaven, he looks at his followers and he said, so as I have loved you, you must love each other. So the law of love is the law of God. The law of God is what Jesus summed up and handed off to his followers. And Paul says, I am not free from God's law, but I'm under Christ's law. So the Jewish law is the way you understand it. The Roman law is the way you understand it. The Greek law is the way you understand it. I'm free from all that. But I'm under Christ's law, which is the law of love. Well, why? So as to win those not having the law. Paul ordered his entire life around the win, to win as many as possible. So he's with the Jews, with the Greeks. He makes sure that he finds common ground so as not to create a barrier for anyone who would pursue relationship with God. And then he says, to those not having, oh, we got that part. To the weak, I became weak. To win the weak, I have become all things to all people, so that by all possible means, I might save some. Now, when Paul says, I have become all things to all people, that doesn't mean that Paul was a big New England Patriots cheater. It doesn't mean that he compromised his character, or gave up his convictions, or did things that he shouldn't do. What it means is that he found common ground with them. It means that he found ways to connect with them as they were in their culture, in their context. I become all things to all people, so that by all possible means. That means if I'm with the Jews, if I eat Jewish food so as not to create an offense and a barrier to them, I'll eat Jewish food. I can do that. If it means when I'm with the Roman citizens, I eat Roman food, even though the Jews don't think I should eat that type of food, guess what? I'm not under that law. I'm under God's law to love people, and I'll become all things to all people, so that in the event that I might win some, help save some, to win as many as possible. So after Paul sets this with the church at Corinth, that this is his win, that this is what he has ordered his life around, he then uses an analogy from the world of sports in their day that the people would have understood and they would have gotten, and we can understand and we can get it as well. He says, "Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one gets the prize?" Now, for those of us who have watched any kind of race, we're like, duh. Because we've all seen it. My son ran track 1 year. My daughter has run track for 7 years. Track's her thing. It is boring as snot to sit there for 3 hours to watch your kid run for 27 seconds. But it's her thing. She loves it. And so we watch. And we watch, you know, there's 8 lanes. And we watch 8 kids line up. We watch 8 kids take their mark. We watch 8 kids go. And we watch one win. And we watch one finish second. And we watch one finish further back. And guess what? We watch somebody finish last. But all through the race, whether it's us watching or the ones running, we all know where they stand. We all know how they're doing. We all know, you know, when you're in that race and you're in first place, guess what you know? You know you're in first place because there ain't anybody in front of you. And if you're in second place, you know you're in second place because there's one person in front of you. And if you're last, you know you're last because you know everybody else is in front of you. In a race, everyone runs, but only one gets the prize. And you always know where you are in relationship to the other competitors because the other competitors are right there next to you. So you always know in a race where you stand. But in life, when we don't clarify the question what the win is, we may never know where we stand because we may never know where the finish line is. And before you know it, you're off course completely. You're not even on the same track with the other people anymore because you're pursuing a win that isn't even the right win anymore. You're pursuing something that you never imagined or ever dreamed you would be pursuing, never realized you were pursuing, because what it is that the wind was kind of snuck up behind you and took over before you even realized it, because you lost sight and you didn't clarify what the wind was. And Paul goes on, everyone who competes, he says, run in such a way as to get the prize. Run as in such a way to get the prize. Order your life around the things that are important. Order your lives around the things that truly matter. Make sure that you clarify and understand and know what it is that you're after. Run in such a way as to get the prize. And here's the thing. When my daughter's running, there are times where we have seen on the third curve when she knows where she stands. I'll look over at Denise and I go, yeah, she just shut it down. She just stopped. She didn't finish the race strong because she knew where she stood. And then there are other times where when we've gone to like county, okay. So my kids go to Greenwood Christian Academy. Hey David, look up from your phone. And how many kids are in the high school at GCA? Maybe 200. So when we run in county, we go run against Whiteland and Greenwood and Center Grove and Edinburgh. Anybody know how many kids? Hey, Chris, how many kids are in Whiteland now? Yeah. Say more than 200? You more than 200? Yeah, probably a little more than 200. Anybody know how many kids are in Center Grove now? Like 6,000, something like that? They have more kids on their track team than we have in one of our classes. And so when we go to county and we run to get the prize, we ask what the prize is. Is the prize first place and the trophy and the ribbon when we go compete against Center Grove and Whiteland and Greenwood and all that? Probably not. Probably the prize is maybe your personal best, or the relay's personal best, or you know, for our daughter, her freshman year, it was to get the school record in the 200 meter. That was it. She wanted that record, and she got that record. And then her sophomore year, another girl who was a freshman took it from her, and so then my daughter took it back, and then the other girl took it back. And then the last track meet of the season, my daughter took it back. And so she's still got her name on the board. But that was the win. So run in such a way to get the prize. If we told them to go and run in a way to beat Center Grove and Whiteland and Greenwood in county and get that first place trophy, guess what? They're defeated before the race even starts. And if in life we say we're going to go after that, whatever it is, and I'm not saying to not set big goals and to not go after big things and stuff like that. I'm not saying that. I'm saying make sure you know what your win is and your win fits in, and then run in a way to get that. That's what Paul's saying. And he says, though it's simple, it's not easy. He says, everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. So everybody in Corinth would have understood, because for like 700 years, Corinth had hosted these little mini Olympic games. And people would come and they would watch the athletes go into training, and they would see the work that they put in to the games, because the people wanted to win to win the prize. And so they would have known when Paul says everyone who competes goes into strict training. They would have seen it. They would have known. And he says they do it to get a crown. So when they were victorious in one of these Olympic games, they got a crown that was made of laurel leaves. But Paul says they get a crown. They do it to get a crown that will not last. Well, the laurel leaf crown, you only got to keep as long as you were the victor. If you lost the next race, they took the crown from you and gave it to somebody else. And if you wanted to rely on your last win, you could do something that they called resting on your laurels, because of the laurel crown. That's where the phrase comes from. That if you wanted to compromise your training and not pursue the win and just wanted to compete based on your last win, then you would rest on your laurels. But they did it for a crown that will not last. And Paul then says, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. winning in the here and now, winning in life is important. And it's good, and it's cool, and we should do it, and we should strive for it. But we should always do it under the perspective of a crown that will last forever. Because here's the deal. Each and every one of us will spend forever somewhere. And when our winning or losing or whatever we do on this earth is done, there is more after that. And so we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Spending right, and there is no greater crown that will last forever than right relationship with God for all eternity through having placed our trust in Jesus. And that's why Paul ordered his life around each and everything to invite people to follow Jesus, to win as many as possible. And he says, therefore, I do not run like someone running aimlessly. So, there have been times in our family where we've left somewhere, athletic event or even church, or left somewhere and we were going to stop and grab something to eat while we were out. And so the question comes up, where do you want to go? Nobody can decide. And so eventually what I say is, if I don't get an answer about where we're going to stop, I'm just going home. Because if I don't know where I'm going, it's very difficult to get there. And so if we don't decide where we're going, and I'll almost always say this, I will not just drive around aimlessly. I suppose that I could just drive somewhere and show up at a restaurant and eat good food. I don't know. Makes a lot more sense when you know where you're going. We haven't done this in a while, but we used to just get in the car and say, let's go on a family adventure. And so our family adventure was, we would pick a direction and we would just drive. We didn't have anywhere that we knew we were going. We were just driving that direction, and we would just pick random roads to drive on. And then if somebody found some place that they thought was a cool place to eat that we'd never tried before, we would stop and eat there. So, I mean, you can do that. But man, when it comes to normal routines of life, it makes a whole lot more sense to get in the car and say, okay, where are we going? All right, we're going to wherever Nolan picked this time. You see, here's the thing, we only have one life. And if we don't clarify the win, the world around us or other people's expectations will become the win. And when we get wrapped up in the winds of the world and we get wrapped up in the winds of the expectations of other people, it's easy to either pursue a finish line that isn't the finish line we should pursue, or it's easy to become so confused by the winds of the world and the winds of the expectations of other people that all of a sudden we're running a course with no boundaries. We're playing a game and we don't even know the rules anymore. I get it. And I've told you guys before, when I was younger, I was really, really competitive, and not in a nice way. I'm still competitive in a lot of ways, but have gotten old, and so some of that competitive edge has mellowed out over time, because as you've gotten older, you sit back and go, wow, that was just stupid. Oh, sorry, Trudy. You know, that didn't matter at all. The kickball game in the neighborhood where I wanted to go and punch you right in your face because you tagged me out and I said I was safe and you said I was out, and then I took my ball and went home and then came back tomorrow and we did it all over again. You know, that just at some point became silly. So, I mean, I get it. It is a whole lot better to win than not win. But the most important win is determining where we stand in right relationship with God. And whether or not we are going to choose to place our trust in Jesus, who gave of himself so that we could win. The early church leader Paul ordered his life around the win, to win as many as possible, because he knew that that was the best possible win that any of us could ever experience. So, what's your win? And then how do you do that? Let me pray for you this morning. Dear God, thank you for this letter that the early church leader Paul wrote. Thank you for the transformation that took place in his life that led to the shift in his win to win as many as possible, which means people like me, because of your great love. Help each and every one of us know what the win is in our life and how best to approach it. Not just to win in life, but maybe to become a part like Paul to win as many as possible. Pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, next week, we'll start to wrap up our year-long start-to-finish thing. We'll kind of wrap it up before the holidays kick in. And so we'll roll the preview video for next week. And then after that, we'll be dismissed. Thanks for being here and choosing to spend this part of your day with us. And now, so here's the deal for me. I have the game on DVR, and I probably won't be done with things that I need to do today until like after 5 o'clock. So no one text me anything about the game, and I'm going to do my best to avoid seeing the score. So I go, you guys already know, don't you? You guys have been back there watching it, haven't you? Yeah, I knew that. I told somebody that, because the Harmon boys back in the sound booth were texting with David last night, and they said they were going to try to figure out a way to put the game on the big screen during the service, which would have been okay. I'd have been fine with that. But I said, you know, and Amanda, I wrote this down as maybe part of our next. Somebody just texted me, and it better not be about the game. I put down that maybe part of applying for the grant next year will be updating our technology back there, where we can put things live on the screen. But then for a day like today, we could picture in picture. So we put what's happening here on the big screen, and then we'd put the game up there in the little corner box so everybody could see. And then I know, you guys would rather have the game on the big box and us on the little box. I get it. So, all right, we're done for today.